Today we commemorate the death of Shakyamuni Buddha over 2,500 years ago. And you can see the classic reclining Buddha on the altar, which we acquired at a flea market in Kyoto. People often call that the sleeping Buddha, but it really he's on his deathbed when he's when you see that position. It's depicting him in his final hours, and here you see him again. This is not exactly a reproduction, but a kind of reproduction of a huge big scroll at a Zen temple that Michael and I lived near in Kyoto, and we every year we'd walk over to see this. It's displayed once a year in this huge big building. It's probably five stories. It's their lecture hall. In monasteries in Japan, the zendo, where the monks meditate, is separate from the kodo, or the lecture hall, and then there's another separate building called the Butsudo, or Buddha Hall, where the services, the chanting services, are held. We just compress it all into one simple little room. So this is in the lecture hall, and the rolled up, it's probably this big, and unscrolled, it's five stories, the height of the building. So it's really big, and it's old, and it's beautifully colored. We tried to color pencil one time, one of these, until the cat wrecked it. but they're marvelous, these traditional scrolls of the Buddha's death. So much detail and so many different characters and all the little animals. So you might want to come and look at it afterwards. Yeah, so in our tradition, this day is celebrated around this time each year. In the Theravadin traditions, it's combined with the Buddha's birth and enlightenment and death are all in one festival, but they're separated. They're separated in Japanese Buddhism, at least. And it's called Parinirvana in the ancient Pali language, which means final enlightenment. Because the belief was that after countless lifetimes, the Buddha became a fully realized Buddha. Or any Buddha. There had been previous Buddhas before Shakyamuni Buddha. And at that point of death, a Buddha would step off the karmic wheel of reincarnation. Into a permanent state of nirvana, free of all clinging and aversion, free of all separation of self and others, a mind of unbounded pure consciousness. Now, in Zen, you don't really hear much about stepping off the wheel, and you don't really hear much about reincarnation. The emphasis is very much on practice in this world, and on the bodhisattva path of practicing with and for all beings. Zen tends to see nirvana and samsara as right here, and not separated by less than a hair's breadth. Right? And you've probably all experienced that, right? How in just a split second you can turn from misery to peace and from peace to misery. Yeah. We've all done it. You may know the story told of the Japanese Rinzai master Hakuin, who was confronted one day by a very arrogant samurai at the temple gate, saying, "If you're such a great Zen master, tell me the difference between heaven and earth." And Hakuin replied, "Well, any idiot knows that. You don't need you don't need me to tell you." The samurai was, of course, affronted and raised his sword, ready to lop off the Zen master's head. And Hakuin was quicker on the draw, and he said, "That's hell." And the samurai kind of froze and then slowly lowered his sword. And Hakuin said, "That's heaven." So, less than a hair's breadth. What moves me even more than the Buddha's legendary achievement of parinirvana, or final enlightenment, is the story of his last months of illness and dying. His utter humanity. He was an old man. He was 80 years old, which must have been an even more venerable age in his time than it is in ours, right? He was not a god, or the son of a god, or even a prophet. He was a wise and compassionate man, and one of the greatest spiritual teachers the world has ever seen. And he died like a man, of dysentery or possibly food poisoning. But he faced his death with dignity, and he offered it up as a teaching. So I thought today it would be good to review that story. Some of you have heard it before. I try and vary it a little bit, but these are, you know, these are kind of, they're legends, but legends have a power, and we can't say how much is historically accurate, but a lot of it rings true, and these stories bear repeating. Remember the earlier story of when the Buddha was Siddhartha Gautama. Siddhartha, his given name. Gautama, his family name. Remember his first encounters with sickness, old age, and death as a young man. Those encounters set him on his path to find out, how does one live free of this kind of suffering that besets the world, which, because he had lived such a sheltered life as a young prince, he didn't really encounter until he was a young adult. Many of us may not have encountered sickness, old age, or death ourselves until we were well into adulthood, or maybe not. Maybe we had early encounters. And certainly all over the world, people have very early encounters with sickness, old age, and death. We are perhaps one of the most cushioned of cultures in that regard. Our culture tends to take sickness, old age, and death as sort of a personal affront. What, me? Or, you know, what, my loved one? How could this happen? But our practice asks us to look deeper. How can we practice turning towards sickness, old age, and death with mindful presence, with compassion, with patience? How can we face the impermanence of everything we know and love? So let's look at how the Buddha did it, how he faced the last year of his life. In his 80th year, after wandering and teaching for 50 years, the Buddha had just finished a retreat, and he was sitting warming himself in the sun. His faithful attendant, Ananda, came and started to give him a leg and foot massage. And Ananda said, "This is amazing. The color of your skin is no longer clear and bright. All your limbs are flaccid and wrinkled. Your body is bent forward, and there seems a change in the sense faculties of your eyes, ears, nose, tongue, and bodily sensation." And the Buddha answered, "So it is, Ananda. The color of my skin is no longer clear and bright. All my limbs are flaccid and wrinkled. My body is bent forward, and there seems a change in the sense faculties of my eyes, ears, nose, tongue, and bodily sensation. It's a lot of repetition in the old sutras. The Buddha had no illusions that he was aging. How many of us have noticed any of those signs lately? I've noticed my skin is getting that sort of, starting to get that kind of creepy look. that old lady look. And I'm challenged to say, you know, because I see old women as very beautiful. I really appreciate the way their, you know, faces are sculpted by age and experience. So to look at ourselves with that same appreciation, yeah. Can we do that? Can we notice these signs without denial, without judgment or aversion, with some equanimity, with some gratitude for the life we've had, for our body and all that is has allowed us to do and see, touch, taste, smell, hear, think, feel, imagine? The Buddha knew he was aging, but he continued to do what he had done for 50 years, traveling from place to place, visiting his many followers, kings and beggars, monks and nuns, laymen and women. Wherever he went, he taught the Dharma. It seems he was making in this time a special effort to review and remind his disciples of his core teachings. These were his gift to the world. He didn't hold back. He gave freely. What is your gift to the world? I know we're not Buddhas, but we're all bodhisattvas in training. And each of us has something unique to offer. There's nobody else in the world like you. What is it that you love to do? What is it you want to do until you're no longer able? What's your particular offering? Might be more than one. Is there something you're still holding back? Afraid of failure, maybe of success? Judgment? How do you express the Dharma in the world? And I don't mean you have to go around preaching the Dharma. The authentic offering of your being, of who you are, just as you are, is your expression of the Dharma. Our practice is to let the impediments drop away, all those obstacles. And when we do that, it automatically benefits other beings. So another thing the Buddha did in the months before he died was to leave words of encouragement and advice to the Sangha, to his community. At one point he asked Ananda to summon all the bhikkhus, or monks, in the area where he was staying, and he gave them a long and comprehensive list of ways by which a community can prosper and not decline. This is a list that any human social organization might do well to follow. I'm just going to give you a sample. Have frequent and well-attended meetings. Well, I'd give us a C+ on that one. Avoid taking pleasure in being busy, gossiping, sleeping, and socializing. Oh, a little bit. A little bit's okay. Maintain both publicly and privately bodily, verbal, and mental acts of loving kindness. Be impartial and indiscriminate sharers with the Sangha of what is lawfully gained, even what is received in the begging bowl. Maintain the 7 factors of enlightenment, which, by the way, are, in case you don't have those memorized, mindfulness, investigation of mental states, energy, happiness, tranquility, concentration, and equanimity. So you could do worse as a community than to practice in that way. What words of encouragement would you leave behind to those you love? To your children, your spouse, your friends? Do you have to wait till you're on your deathbed to say those words? Maybe not. Several months before his death, the Buddha was very, very sick with what sounds like a severe attack of dysentery. And I'm just going to read you a little passage about that from The Life of the Buddha by Bhikkhu Nanamoli. Bhikkhu Nanamoli compiled from the various ancient early texts and put in chronological order all the biographical content about the Buddha's life. So this is a great resource. It's really helpful because you can't find one continuous account in any text. It's from various sources. After the Buddha had taken up residence for the rains, a severe sickness attacked him with violent and deadly pains. He bore them without complaint, mindful and fully aware. Then he thought, "It is not right for me to attain final nirvana," meaning to die, "without having addressed my attendants and taking leave of the Sangha. Suppose I forcibly suppress this illness by prolonging the will to live." He did so, and then the sickness abated. So he decided, "I'm not going to let this illness sweep me away just yet." The Buddha recovered from that sickness. Soon afterward, he came out from the sick room and sat on a seat made ready at the back of the dwelling. The Venerable Ananda, his attendant, went to him and said, "I have been used to seeing you in comfort and in health, Lord. Indeed, with your sickness, I felt as if my body were quite rigid. I could not see straight. My ideas were all unclear. However, Lord, I comforted myself knowing that you would not attain final nirvana without a pronouncement about the Sangha." So Ananda's reaction, if you've ever, found out about, for example, a terminal illness that someone you love, one of those frightening diagnoses, Ananda's reaction is kind of how you feel, isn't it? "Felt as if my body were quite rigid, I could not see straight, and my ideas were all unclear." So, very human, a very, very human reaction. But he says, "I knew you wouldn't, you wouldn't die without giving a final message to the Sangha." So the Buddha says, "But Ananda, what does the Sangha expect of me? The Dharma I have taught has no secret and public versions. There is no teacher's closed fist." He's saying, I haven't held back anything. There's no hidden and public. "Now I am old, Ananda. My years have turned 80. Just as an old cart is made to carry on with the help of makeshifts, so too, it seems to me, my body is made to carry on with the help of makeshifts. My body is only at ease with non-attention to all signs and with cessation of certain kinds of feeling when I enter upon and dwell in the signless heart deliverance." So he's saying only when I'm in a state of very deep meditative concentration am I comfortable. "So, Ananda, each of you should make himself a lamp, himself and no other refuge. Each of you should make the Dhamma your lamp, the Dhamma and no other refuge." How does a bhikkhu do that? Bhikkhu is a monk. "The bhikkhu abides contemplating the body as a body, ardent, fully aware and mindful, having put away covetousness and grief for the world. He abides contemplating feelings as feelings, contemplating consciousness as consciousness, contemplating mental objects as mental objects. So he's describing the basic practice of mindfulness, the four foundations of mindfulness. That's how you take refuge. That's how you are a light unto yourself. That's how you are to practice after I'm gone, is what he's saying. So he's preparing Ananda to continue without him. He's saying the Sangha doesn't need special pronouncements. They must simply take refuge in this practice that I've taught you. So not long after that illness, the Buddha was visited by Mara, the demon of temptation and doubt. I find it both poignant and encouraging to think that after the Buddha's enlightenment under the Bodhi tree, so 50 years earlier, that Mara, the demon of temptation and doubt, continued to appear to him a number of times throughout his life, and here at the very end, he appears once more. Of course, Mara represents our inner voices of desire, aversion, doubt, and the Buddha must have been very well acquainted with these voices, because he was able to remain steadfast and see through their strategies. So by the time he meets Mara towards the end of his life, it's like they're kind of like old friends. And Mara says, he kind of urges the Buddha to say, to go ahead and let go, you know. He's saying, you're tired, you've done enough, the Sangha will be fine. It's time for you to step off the wheel of karma and be free. He said, you know, enough already. You can let go. But the Buddha replies, no, he will not die until he deemed that the Sangha was mature and steady in their practice and ready to continue on and teach the Dharma to others. So he announces to Mara that he will live 3 more months and then consciously let go of his life. So 3 months later, the final illness came as predicted. It seems to have been a case of food poisoning. The Buddha and his Sangha were invited to dinner by a man named Kunda, who was the son of a goldsmith, and much good food was served, including something that has been translated as hog's mincemeat, but it's literally sweet pig. And so there's been much scholarly debate about whether the food was in fact pork or bamboo shoots that grow in places trampled by pigs or a kind of mushroom that grows in places trampled by pigs or is sniffed up, you know, how pigs sniff for truffles, right? So there's something associated with pigs about this food, but it could have been a poisonous mushroom. At any rate, what's important to note is the Buddha gave specific instructions that no one else should eat this food but himself. And after that, he became deathly ill. He made certain to instruct Ananda that Kunda should not be blamed for causing his death. I mean, imagine how you'd feel poisoning the Buddha. But that in fact, Kunda should be praised for his generosity and that this meal should be considered as important as the meal that the milkmaid gave the Buddha when he had been starving and doing extreme austerities before he went to sit under the Bodhi tree when he became enlightened. He said, this offering is just as important, this meal. So this story makes me think, well, it's moving that the Buddha was, you know, dying and careful to make sure that this man would not be blamed, but it makes me think of how strongly we are inclined to assign blame when an accident or an illness or a death occurs. How difficult it is to see the complex links of cause and effect that have converged in this particular illness or accident or death. When I used to work as a a hospice counselor with bereaved people, I often saw a kind of inner torment that people carried around a particular ascription of blame, whether a doctor or sometimes the person themselves who resisted going to the doctor for months on end until their illness was too late to treat. When something so out of control happens, being able to ascribe blame, whether other blame or self-blame, sometimes it's self-blame, gives us a sense of control, a retroactive sense of control. It can be a way of hanging on. So this is one more way we can practice with sickness, aging, and death, by applying mindful awareness to our tendency to blame, to our tendency to try and hang on to a simplified version of control. Loosening our grip on the control stick of our lives, and developing compassion for human vulnerability and imperfection. In this final illness, even though he was desperately ill, the Buddha tried to travel further with his Sangha, but he became too weak to continue and lay down in the grove of sala trees, as depicted here. Even then, he took further steps to prepare the Sangha for his death. He did not neglect practical matters. In a wonderful passage, Ananda asks him three questions. First, he says that during the rainy season, the Sangha would stop wandering and stay in one place and meditate, and have an actual sort of meditation retreat. He said during the rainy season, Sangha members like to come from different parts of the country to see you and be in your presence. What should they do once you're gone? And the Buddha says they should make pilgrimages to the places where the Buddha was born, where he was enlightened, gave his first teaching, and died, as Buddhist practitioners do to this day. Has anyone here been to those locations? Yeah, I know a number of people have been, to made that pilgrimage. And then, second question, Ananda asks, Lord, how are we to treat women? Now keep in mind, Ananda was the one who intervened on behalf of women wanting to be ordained into the Sangha. And the Buddha refused. He refused three times. And Ananda challenged him and said, are women just as capable of enlightenment as men? And the Buddha had to agree. So he had to consent to admit women into the Sangha. So when Ananda asks, how are we to treat women? The Buddha answers, do not see them, Ananda. Just don't look at them. Ananda persists. He says, and if they are seen, how should we treat them? Buddha says, do not address them, Ananda. Just don't talk to them. But Ananda still isn't satisfied. He knows the power of sexual attraction, and perhaps even more the human need to connect, to be seen, to be heard. So he asks, Lord, if we do not address them, how should we treat them? And the Buddha replies, mindfulness should be maintained, Ananda. Mindfulness should be maintained. I really love this passage because it shows Ananda being a teacher to his teacher, patiently insisting that he deal with this sticky question of gender and sexuality. Just saying don't look and don't speak isn't a good enough answer. Only by being mindful of body, feelings, thoughts, and actions can we conduct ourselves in respectful and caring ways when it comes to gender and sexuality. We are still working on it, 2.5 millennia later, right? So thank you, Ananda. In Japan, Zen nuns have a ceremony of gratitude to Ananda, which Last year I went to Soto Zen National Conference, and a woman taught us a little bit how to do it. So maybe we'll do a thank you Ananda ceremony one day. Next, third question, Ananda asks how the Buddha's remains should be treated. And the Buddha gives detailed instructions for the preparation and wrapping of the body, the making of the funeral pyre, and the construction of a monument where the remains can be interred. How many of you, I'm not asking for a show of hands, how many of you have put in writing what you would like done with your remains when you die? It's something we tend to put off. Right. Oh, that won't happen for a long time. It's so easy, you know, to see our own death as somewhere in the distant future and procrastinate, you know, making a will, stating what we want done with our property, whether we want cremation or burial, wishes for our funeral. And what about a living will that states our wishes for what we'd want if we were unable to make our own decisions at the end of life, in terms of medical care? This kind of forethought that the Buddha had, even on his deathbed, is a gift to those who are left behind. As any of you know, if you've had to deal with attending to the affairs of a loved one who has died when there wasn't that kind of information available. So as you see, the Buddha did not neglect the practical aspects of his impending death, but he showed his love for his Sangha most beautifully in the way he entrusted the practice to them. Even in his final illness, he ordained one last disciple, a man named Subhadda, who showed up wanting to see the Buddha, having heard of his illness, wanting to be ordained, and Ananda tried to turn him away, you know, please. You know. But the Buddha insisted on receiving this man and ordaining him. And then he turned to Ananda and said, "You may think, Ananda, the word of the teacher is a thing of the past. Now we have no more teacher. But you should not regard it so. The Dharma and the practice taught by me and laid down for you are your teacher when I am gone." In the end, the Buddha called the Sangha together, asked if they had any last questions for him, which they didn't. Then he declared, "It is the nature of all formations to dissolve. Attain perfection through diligence." Those were said to be his last words. The nature of all formations, that means the nature of all things in the phenomenal world, is to dissolve. Practice on with diligence. He then entered progressive states of meditative concentration and died. There was a great earthquake, followed by the recitation of verses by several of his disciples, as well as various deities present. You'll see them all up there. The suttas say that among those present, both human and deities, there were those who lamented and wept, and those who are aware that all conditioned existence is impermanent and subject to dissolution. So you'll see those, some are weeping and some are not, both human and deities. So this story of the Buddha's last months of life, I think, gives us some ways to consider how we can live in this world of inevitable loss. Of our own lives, of those we love. And we all feel, I think, an anxiety about this, the world itself, you know, the beings in this world. So the Buddha story teaches us about not turning away from aging, not waiting to offer our particular gifts to the world, saying what we need to say to those we love and care about, or near saying what we need to say beyond those who immediately we love and care about, expressing our love for the world, taking care of practical concerns before we die, and most fundamentally, practicing what this way of living in the world, I want to say practice not only the meditation practice, but the Eightfold Path, which is a pretty comprehensive way of living in the world. The world calls us to wake up with each breath right now. And our bodhisattva vow is to listen to those calls. Wake up. Samsara and nirvana are a hair's breadth apart. Less than that. When we deeply trust the light of the Dharma within us, we are simultaneously a lamp unto ourselves and a lamp to others. And the Buddha passed that light on to us with the gift of his death. So on this day, we express our gratitude for that by doing a very simple ceremony of light. So let's do our Dharma Talk closing chant, and then we'll explain the ceremony, okay? So thank you, everyone. Thank you for coming, and thank you for listening to this story. Thank you.